Law's connection to morality is ancient. This is a phrase from Tina Liu and Carolyn Strange's book, Making Good, Law and Moral Regulation in Canada. And I offer it because it's the driving force of today's episode. The criminalization of certain acts represents a society's moral values and what it will tolerate. But what happens when these socially established moral values are also explicitly gendered? Hi, everyone. I hope that you are all doing well on this chilly, chilly morning. I'm your host, Annie Dowd, and welcome to another episode of Historia, the podcast where we consider historical issues of importance as they continue to affect our present. I'm very passionate about today's content, so let's hop right in. All right. In today's podcast, we'll be exploring the way that social values of femininity and female sexuality shape gendered perceptions of crime throughout Canada. I plan to focus our discussion on roughly the 1930s through to the 1950s. Female crime was deeply rooted in social norms, where the legislation that governed women and the institutions built to reform them were similarly influenced. This phenomenon will be examined through specific legal infrastructures, such as the Ontario Female Refugees Act and the Andrew Mercer Reformatory for Women. Ultimately, perceptions of female crime as a threat to powerful social and political structures stirred moral fear within society and among policymakers. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, we will consider the way that gender and race intersected to uniquely shape the perceptions and experiences of marginalized women and crime, particularly of Indigenous women in Canada. So how was crime gendered during the early and mid-20th century? And how did this connect to social expectations of femininity and female sexuality? How was the breaking of gender-specific criminal law perceived as a threat to moral society? And in what ways did legislation and penal institutions reflect such widespread perceptions? Why bother asking these questions at all? These are all core issues that we will divulge in today's segment of Historia. So for those of you who are new to the show, we always introduce our historical issue by providing some historical context. So, when situating social values of femininity and female sexuality, as well as connected perceptions of female crime in historical context, it is important to consider the evolving social, political, and ideological landscape of Canada throughout the early to mid-20th century. Ideology regarding femininity and female sexuality were often shaped by major historical events, such as the Great Depression and the World Wars. However, one consistency can be identified. Women encountered heavy sexual and moral regulation within society and by the state. But why? In her article, Incarcerating Bad Girls, The Regulation of Sexuality Through the Female Refugees Act in Ontario from 1920 to 1945, Joan Sangster explains that moral and sexual regulation of women peaked during the 1930s and 1940s, particularly during the interwar period. Sangster suggests that during the interwar period, fears regarding working-class sexuality and reproduction were heightened, spotlighting social concern regarding female crime. Perceptions of women and subsequent regulation experienced a shift in the late 1940s through to the 1950s, to remedy post-war moral anxieties. Convictions after World War II can be chalked up to underlying fears that working-class girls were in danger of becoming unruly, overly sexual women. This remained a constant fear as a result of women's increasing role in the workforce and public sphere. Now, with a brief understanding of the time period in question, we can dissect how this social climate nourished social values of femininity and female sexuality, which helped to form perceptions of female crime. In her article, Women, Crime, and Penal Responses, A Historical Account, Lucia Zedner explains the popular historical perception of female crime by describing the perceived female criminal. Zedner describes her as follows: excessively erotic, weak in maternal feeling, inclined to dissipation, astute, and audacious. By this definition, Zedner establishes the social archetype of the female criminal as the antithesis of femininity. It follows that this portrait of the female criminal, by deduction, reveals the ideal embodiment of femininity and female sexuality. Using Zedner's definition, we can assert that sexual repression and conformity, inherent maternalism, domesticity, and submissiveness then constituted the social ideal of femininity. Sangster and Zedner can be placed in conversation to establish in what context values of femininity and sexuality stemmed, propagating notions that any contradictory behavior constituted criminality. Have you all made the connection yet that female crime was then associated with the deviance from traditional social values, connecting women with very specific criminalized activities? This was both reflected in and perpetuated by related legislation and institutions. Let's first look at the Ontario Female Refugees Act, which is kind of a mouthful, so from this point on, I'll refer to it as the FRA. So the FRA was a gender-specific piece of legislation, as described by Wendy Chan and Kiran Mirchandani in their book, Crimes of Color, Racialization, and the Criminal Justice System in Canada. They explain that it was intentionally enacted as a tool to regulate female morality and sexuality. To provide some brief background, the FRA was initially enacted in 1897, designating certain institutions as separate spaces of shelter and work for female reform. The FRA targeted women between the ages of 15 and 35. There was also an apparent class-based prejudice in the enactment of the FRA. The initial target was lower-class, Anglo-Saxon, reformable white women. However, as we will discuss later, this target was not fixed. There were multiple amendments to the Act over the years. However, the gendered motivation behind this Act remained consistent. I would argue that the FRA offers insight into prominent social values which permeated societal and legal perceptions of crime and criminality. I thought that we could start off by considering the way that social values and perceptions of female crime were represented and reinforced through the FRA by examining the legislation in practice. Joan Sangster proposes that FRA convictions were derived from three main categories of activity which tended to intertwine. We have sexual promiscuity or nonconformity, illegitimate pregnancies, and venereal disease. This included convictions for prostitution, interracial relationships, pregnancy while unmarried, having too many sexual partners, vagrancy, and public alcohol consumption. Oh, how times and popular social attitudes have changed. This legislation propagated the notion of female crime as intrinsically sexual and moralistic, rooted in deviance from social values of femininity and female sexuality. Crimes such as murder were ideologically tied to masculine traits of dominance, aggression, and violence, separating these crimes from women entirely. Whereas crimes of prostitution, for example, were ideologically tied to the defiance of feminine traits. Therefore, the FRA created a division of criminal spheres based on gendered ideology, in which female crime was linked to sexual and moral aberration. A narrower examination of the legislation itself reveals the gendered moral and sexual regulation that defined the FRA and the double standard of crime it perpetuated through specific provisions. I think it is valuable to note that moral regulation through policy was not always gender-specific. A well-known example of moral policy would be the Prohibition Act, which prohibited alcohol consumption, creation, and distribution with a greater agenda for national morality, and this impacted all genders. However, the FRA directly targeted women through gendered regulation. The FRA itself permitted charges against any female between the ages of 15 and 35. To return to my earlier point, this tells us a lot about the legislation's intent, as it restricts its focus to women who, as Chan and Mirchandani identify, as in their prime reproductive years. This suggests that a woman's reproductive capacity was significant in gender-specific crime and regulation. Although this was also the age at which most men were likely to reproduce, Sangster explains, No equivalent law was used to incarcerate heterosexual men between the ages of 15 and 35 for promiscuity. Here, we see an obvious double standard in which women's promiscuity was exclusively criminalized, equating women with sexually deviant criminality in a way that men were not. The legislation also stated that any person may bring before a judge any female, giving power to anyone from a parent, to police, to welfare authorities, to press charges. As no formal information shall be requisite to bring a woman before a judge, the foundation of a woman's conviction was oftentimes the word of men in positions of authority. This perpetuated the ideology that femininity was synonymous with subordination, and that ideal femininity maintained structures of male dominance. Sangster suggests that through this familial model, the law implicitly reinforced and stressed adult and masculine authority structures. Ultimately, this section reveals that women's subjection to social values of femininity and female sexuality, which were often determinants of their criminality, were gatekept by men. This maintained a patriarchal approach to law and social order. So far, the intentions of the FRA have been quite conspicuous, with little room for interpretation or ambiguity. However, there were more subtle undertones of gendered criminalization based in widespread social values. The legislation employed the words unmanageable and incorrigible as grounds for charges. The ambiguity of this language casts a wide net with which to regulate women. Sangster speculates that such words as incorrigible were often code for promiscuity, for which the FRA created institutions to interact. Again, the lack of specificity in what actually constituted incorrigibility or unmanageability left statutory interpretation up to the person bringing a woman before a judge and the judge themselves. Relating back to my previous argument, the criminality of a woman, based on her adherence to social values, was at the discretion of male authority. I hope that by now it's become evident that the FRA was a socially and politically driven piece of legislation, employed to establish and reinforce perceptions of female crime and regulate the sexual and moral behavior of women. The results of FRA convictions varied. However, many women were subsequently sent to the Andrew Mercer Reformatory for Women to remedy their social disillusion. We will now turn our attention to the Andrew Mercer Reformatory, another example of institutional infrastructure inspired by and perpetuating perceptions of female crime. The Andrew Mercer Reformatory can be used to examine how expectations of femininity and sexuality manifested within institutions of reform was purporting perceptions of female crime. Let's break down the Andrew Mercer Reformatory, shall we? The Mercer was Canada's first exclusively female reform institution, opening its doors in 1880 and remaining active until 1969. The institution emerged as a result of state reformers, most notably J.W. Langmuir, an Ontario prison inspector. Langmuir proposed and promoted what Professor of Criminology and Sociology Kelly Hannah Moffat describes as distinctly feminine disciplinary methods. Female discipline, met with a maternal approach to reform, shaped the deeply gendered ideals of the institution. Historian Carolyn Strange speaks to this gender-specific approach, stating, Langmuir drew easily upon popular notions of femininity to portray the unique nature of women as both offenders and reformers. Innately, the Mercer was infused with methods of reform that both reflected and reinforced femininity as a means to combat the anti-feminine female criminal. It also deepened the divide between female crime, male reform, and female reform, really solidifying the isolated spheres of crime which encompass each gender. There are infinite angles from which to study the Mercer. However, for the purposes of today's podcast, I will be focusing on the unique labor regime as to represent expectations of femininity, sexuality, and perceptions of female crime as existing within reform institutions. We will also interrogate the realities of such gendered methods using a primary source document. A quick interlude before the main point. In its early years, the Mercer was not referred to or built to resemble a prison, but rather a house. This was a very different structure when compared to male prisons. Implicitly, the conscious decision to create a home environment suggested and reinforced the idea that femininity bound women to the home, and that in order to achieve reform, women must concede to their inherent role as homemakers. This is a subtle but telling example of the way that social expectations of femininity and female sexuality were embedded in perceptions of female crime. All right, back on track. Such ideals were further perpetuated through the gender-specific labor regime employed. Hannah Moffat explains that norms of domesticity and the ideal of true womanhood were central to Mercer's programming. They offered moral and domestic training that included lessons on knowing one's place in society. This was executed through labor that reinforced traditional gender roles, such as laundering, sewing, knitting, and domestic service. This approach to female reform bolstered the gendered ideology that female crime was rooted in a deviance from values of femininity and female sexuality, where the solution was to reinstill these values into inmates. This moralistic-based reform supposedly prepared women to re-enter society, allowing them to slip back into their domestic, feminine, sexually conforming roles, and eliminating any threat to society. Overall, this labor regime confirmed female crime as an aberration from social values by prescribing conformity as the antidote. The efficacy of reform employed at the Mercer can be used to challenge popular perceptions of female crime. I would argue that there was an evident discrepancy between the expectations of femininity and its capacity to reform female crime and the lived realities. A newspaper article published by The Globe and Mail in 1947, at the height of both the FRA and the Mercer, can be employed for analysis. The article entitled Inside Mercer, Liquor, Drugs, Downfall of Most Women Behind Bars, Regime Strict, Results Doubtful, considers how moralistic-based reform and domestic labor regimes were carried out in practice through the lens of a reporter. Reporter Kay Sanford lived in at the Mercer for several days, gaining a very authentic perspective. In the article, Sanford first comments on the sexually related crimes resulting in the incarceration of every woman she met. This would have perpetuated, through the media, a connection between moral and feminine deviance and female crime. However, Sanford goes on to reveal that the feminine labor regime and domestic training used by the Mercer gave women no firm basis for proper behavior in the outside world, and that many women were repeat offenders. This document challenges the perception of female crime as a deviance from social values, since teaching these values to women was not very effective in eliminating female crime. Another fascinating element from the article that I would like to point out comes from an observation made by Sanford when she's describing the female inmates. She says, "They wear no cosmetics." This quick comment caught my attention, as the female criminals, even within the prison walls, were subject to scrutiny about both their internal and external embodiments of femininity. I would speculate that a reporter investigating male penal institutions would not present similar critiques. I mention this as I believe it ties back to my earlier point about the historical double standard between masculinity and femininity within perceptions of crime. This also further solidifies how deeply endowed the expectations of femininity were in society. Now, with a solid foundation for my argument that social values of femininity and sexuality influence gendered perceptions of female crime, and that such values and perceptions were reflected in and perpetuated by legal infrastructures, we arrive at the million-dollar question. Why was it imperative to society and policymakers to regulate the sexual and moral conduct of women? Why was maintaining social values of femininity and female sexuality so valuable that contrasting behavior by women had to be criminalized? Again, I turn to a quote by Joan Sangster to establish a base for my looming argument. It was not simply women's pathological promiscuity, but its very real threat to the nuclear family and traditional marriage that fueled the convictions of many women. This theory suggests the significant moralistic approach to female crime, framing divergence from traditional femininity and sexual conformity as an attack on foundational social ideologies. Transgressions of sexual conformity and femininity defied the ingrained expectations of womanhood, which were central to maintaining greater social constructs, such as the patriarchy, the nuclear family unit, and traditional gender roles. Female crime threatened these structures, which required a dominant male breadwinner and a submissive maternal female in order to thrive. As Sangster explains, these structures preserved social and material power for their beneficiaries, which included policymakers, men in positions of authority, and the white middle-class demographic. The perception follows that society had a greater stake in regulating female behavior and preventing female crime. Female crime was perceived not exclusively as a threat to an emerging law and order, but a threat to the social fabric of a moral society. Wendy Chan and Kiran Mirchandani add to this argument, explaining that the protection of what were deemed proper familial roles was inextricably linked to the regulation of women's sexuality. Since sexuality and femininity can be argued as inherently entwined with morality in legal and societal perceptions, the failure to adhere to such expectations was seen to have moral consequences. How then was this social and political agenda carried out? Well, through criminalizing women who engaged in conduct that diluted their femininity, sexuality, and ultimately morality by the traditional patriarchal standard. Policymakers aimed to uphold the aforementioned social constructs through legal means. Thus we see the FRA and the Mercer. These institutions were designed with the purpose to criminalize any behavior deemed threatening to a moral society, implying that the greatest threat of all was unregulated women. The final point that I will consider in today's episode is the way that gender and race intersected to uniquely shape the perceptions and experiences of Indigenous women. How did the previously discussed legislations and institutions operate differently when intention to regulate and criminalize gendered and racialized bodies? Chan and Mirchandani explain that following the late 1940s, the number of Native women incarcerated under the FRA multiplied, revealing an evident shift in the target of this legislation. The author suggests that this increase in incarceration was directly connected to the intensifying effects of colonialism on Indigenous women and communities. A large portion of FRA convictions of Indigenous women were claimed to be related to alcohol and charges linked to sexual immorality. Indigenous women during this period were perceived by widespread Canadian society and authorities as weaker in moral outlook as well as more prone to promiscuity. This resulted in the ideology that Indigenous women required extensive paternalist guidance back to moral, feminine, and sexual conformity. However, the social values of femininity and female sexuality by which they were measured were based on Western colonial middle-class notions. Ultimately, their identity as women held them to a gender-based expectation of femininity, and their identity as Indigenous resulted in race-based perceptions that they were destined to fall short. As these social ideologies existed in tandem, Indigenous women were criminalized uniquely and disproportionately under the FRA. Joan Sangster articulates the underlying racial motivations that manifested in the criminalization of Indigenous women under the FRA and within similar colonial policies. The sexual regulation of Native and non-Native women alike was part of a broader project of nation-building. The creation of moral families, based on Western, largely Anglo, middle-class notions of sexual purity, marital monogamy, and distinct gender roles of the female homemaker and the male breadwinner, was an important means of creating moral and responsible citizens, the bedrock of the nation. I believe that this quote encompasses the moral, feminine, and sexual expectations that characterized female crime, imparted onto all women during the period, whilst effectively identifying the added component that these values were pillared on colonial Western standards of womanhood. It also alludes to popular eugenic sentiments, which, I say with horror, contributed to the heavy incarceration of Indigenous women. Although this is a much deeper issue that we unfortunately do not have time to effectively interrogate today. This racial tinge compounded the perception of female crime and bore incredibly harmful stereotypes about Indigenous women and their sexual conduct that are reflected in the overrepresentation in today's criminal justice system. Finally, in the context of the Andrew Mercer Reformatory, we can consider what type of women were deemed reformable. Within the Mercer, the pinnacle of reform was the white woman, often a first-time offender, as they were expected to have the moral capacity and ability to be reformed. The racist and classist biases that denounced alcoholism and promiscuity as congenital in Indigenous women excluded them from this categorization. Chan and Mirtandani explained that, once incarcerated, Native women still encountered assumptions shared by male and female medical and penal experts that they lacked the moral introspection necessary to reform themselves. This assumption can be linked to accompanying prejudices of Indigenous women as lacking in femininity, sexual conformity, and subsequent morality that was assumed of and attributed to white women. This created a paradox in which the group that supposedly required the most reform was not the focus of reform efforts. The question then becomes, what was the goal of incarcerating Indigenous women if not for reform? As we sadly draw to a close, I felt it important to discuss why I chose to extend this conversation to you, my audience, in today's podcast. The intended purpose of this discussion was to generate public reflection on the history of gender and criminal justice, as well as to raise awareness of the continued, lasting effects of gendered perceptions of crime. Zedner explains that within the disciplinary of criminal justice history, men have often been the focus of study, leaving the experiences of women and the influence of gender on perceptions of crime largely undivulged. Although certain scholars argue that the histories of marginalized communities are gaining traction, many academics share the idea that women in particular have been marginal to the big important questions, including those within criminal justice history. As male crime throughout history was more ubiquitous and documented, there is consequently more information from which historians can draw conclusions today. Because prison systems and policies were built with the male criminal in mind, and male-perpetuated crime was more common and palatable by society, female criminals were not the primary concern during the time period, and histories have reflected this. The effects of moral and sexual regulation of women and the perceptions of female crime continue to have lasting effects in the present. One need only look as far as Velma Demerson, a woman who herself was incarcerated at the Andrew Mercer Reformatory in 1939 under the FRA for having sexual relations with a Chinese man and getting pregnant with his child while unwed. In her powerful memoir, Incorrigible, Demerson discloses her experiences as a female criminal and the severe abuse she faced at the Andrew Mercer Reformatory. More than 60 years later, Demerson did receive an apology letter from the federal government for her suffering, as well as a monetary settlement. But the fact that it took 60 years and a published novel outlining the discrimination and abuse she faced to receive any direct government action, as well as her extensive public advocacy for justice, and yet Canada's general population does not know her story, is disheartening. Velma Demerson represents the very real consequences of the FRA. Similarly, the stereotypes connecting Indigenous women to sexual deviance and female crime continue to penetrate society and Canada's criminal justice system. This broad conversation is intended to educate a general audience about a history that is absent in the public consciousness but remains present within the systems and perceptions that persist today. Today's podcast explored the way that social values of femininity and female sexuality shape gendered perceptions of crime throughout Canada, where moral and sexual regulation of women was identified in the 1930s through to the 1950s. As female crime stemmed from social norms, this was reflected in regulatory legislation and reform institutions, specifically the Ontario Female Refugees Act and the Andrew Mercer Reformatory for Women. Perceptions of female crime incited moral fear within society and policymakers as potential threats to deeply embedded and intentional social and political power structures. it is important to employ an intersectional lens, considering the way that race and gender intersected to uniquely shape the perceptions and treatment of Indigenous women in Canada. By exploring these concepts and themes, I hope that education regarding historical perceptions and experiences of female crime, and their perpetual effects, reaches a greater audience. There were many avenues from which this topic could have been considered. I could have discussed each theme mentioned today in a podcast of its own, due to the complex nature of this history and the actors involved. However, I opted to provide a broad analysis and consider multiple pockets of criminal justice history as pertaining to women and gender. I encourage each of you to take a deeper look into a specific area that interests you, whether it be the FRA, the criminalization of Indigenous women, or any other sub-theme we've discussed. I will leave you today with the same idea that I began with. The criminalization of certain acts represents a society's moral values and what it will tolerate. What will historians a century from now consider to be tolerable by our current society? And what does this say about us? If you have enjoyed today's podcast, please be sure to like and follow Historia on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And tune into next week's episode, where special guest Joan Sangster herself will be joining us as an extension of today's episode. I would like to extend a huge thank you to the many brilliant authors and historians cited in my research today. A full list of sources can be found in the attached document below. Thank you so much for listening, everyone, and stay safe. We'll be right back.